Sign up today for the Film Comment Letter. It's a free weekly digital newsletter featuring original film criticism and writing by Film Comment's editors and brilliant contributors.
The letter delivers exclusive features, reviews, interviews, streaming picks, news, and more directly to subscribers' inboxes before they're published on filmcomment.com the following Monday.
Sign up today at filmcomment.com. Welcome to the Film Comment Podcast. I'm Devika Girish.
And I'm Clinton Crute. We're the editors of Film Comment.
This week, one of our favorite annual festivals opens at Film at Lincoln Center. Every spring, the New Directors New Films Festival puts on an exciting showcase of movies by the best emerging filmmakers around the world. It's always a reliable sign of the trends to come and the talents to look out for. Past editions have featured early films by Spike Lee, Christopher Nolan, Kelly Reichardt, and others.
Over the past few years, we've established our own annual Film Comment tradition of previewing the best movies in the New Directors New Films lineup with local critics. This time around, we were joined by Vadim Rizov and Alyssa Wilkinson for a rundown of some of the gems in the 2024 edition, including A Good Place, Dreaming and Dying, The Day I Met You, Explanation for Everything, and more.
We hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome, Vadim, Alyssa. Thank you for joining us. Vadim, you want to introduce yourself? You're a New Directors New Films fave.
Oh, what a pleasure. pandemic-rooted tradition. I am Vadim Rizov, Director of Editorial Operations at Filmmaker Magazine, quarterly print, daily online.
Lovely. Alyssa?
Hi, I'm Alyssa Wilkinson. I'm movie critic at the New York Times.
I believe daily in print?
Sometimes.
And daily.
Yeah, more like, you know, weekends, but you never really
take that,
know
buddy.
When your stuff appears on the paper.
Clint, do you have any a succinct, pithy self-description?
Just a guy on the podcast.
Weekly on audio.
Yep. Yes.
All right. So, New Directors New Films is always kind of an exciting time for me. It has a soft spot for me even above the more major festivals, you know, because it's such a wonderful place to discover new filmmakers and kind of like more audacious work that sometimes doesn't necessarily feel fully formed yet, but it's so mm-hmm. delightful to see, you know, someone whose vision is clearly promising. And there's actually quite a few films in that vein for me in this year's lineup, which, you know, may not be perfect, whatever that word means, but are exciting because you see something new being tried out and this is a director you'll want to keep an eye out for. However, I think the opening night film is one that feels, I wouldn't say perfect, but feels very fully formed. It's a very kind of strong vision, and it is by a director who's already made a few films. I'm talking about A Different Man by Aaron Schimberg, and it did play at Sundance, where Vadim and I actually talked about it in quite some detail with a lot of enthusiasm. So we're not going to get into it again on this podcast, but I just wanted to mention that people who are interested in hearing our thoughts should check out our Sundance podcast on it, because I really think it's a wonderful film, and I'm excited for people to discover it. But let's move on to some other things that were at least new to, I think, many of us, even those who do the festival circuit. And one of those is The Day I Met You, a really fun film that was not on my radar until it showed up on the New Directors lineup. I know that Vadim, Clint have both seen it as well. Clint, maybe you want to start us off. I know you really liked it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I liked it. It's really a sweet movie. You know, it's doesn't have a very wide scope. It's not trying to do too much, but within that space, it's quite effective. It's a Brazilian film directed by André Novais Oliveira, and it's about I don't know. I wouldn't say middle-aged, young to middle-aged man who's a bro who's living with a roommate and who is perpetually late to work. And the opening scene is this long conversation between him and his roommate about how he wants his roommate to wake him up so he can make it to work on time and his at his job as a school librarian at an elementary school. And he tells his roommate to throw water on him if he doesn't wake up. Ultimately, the next morning, he does not wake up. He's late. And after some misadventures during the bus ride, he arrives late and is fired from his job, which he seems to be quite good at. He's, you know, again, this movie is very sweet. There's a lot of interactions between him and some children, and you're like, oh, he's just like a nice guy. And this, he's just cuddly. Can't get up on time. You know, yeah. There's just certain people who are perpetually late to things. It's like there's something inside of them that can't, that does not allow, I'm not saying anybody here necessarily. But certain people just have this. And he's cuddly for sure. So then he gets a ride home with a coworker, and they kind of strike up this romance. And the rest of the film kind of is just this night when which follows the rest of the night. And they kind of, you know, fall in love, kind of, you know, or, you know, they have this little thing. And it's just a really sweet and gentle kind of chamber piece, I guess, in some ways. But what I thought was most interesting about it was the use of music. The film uses a piece of music by the American composer William Grant Still that sounds kind of in the vein of like more well-known pieces by like Aaron Copland, this kind of triumphant but kind of drifting too at the same time and very romantic. And so you have these kind of everyday scenes of this couple hanging out and drinking a beer or walking down the street, long tracking shot of them walking down the street together, kind of gently bumping into each other, scored to this really lush, romantic music. So I thought it was an interesting and very pleasant little film.
Yeah, it really is so pleasant. And when it started, I was concerned that it would be, you know, pleasant, but also kind of trite, like a slacker movie that had kind of television like vibes. Yeah, or a rom-com. You know, the opening sequence, which you described, Clint, in which the roommate is told to wake up the protagonist, and then he tries to wake him up. And there's all these little cuts to objects in the room, including a Shrek flower pot or a pot.
Did you notice also, I think in the credits, the opening credits, somebody's credited with like little objects, like somebody who is in charge of like figure, because throughout the film it cuts to these little kind of knickknacks and stuff.
I didn't notice that in the credits, but that kind of explains then, you know, the attention paid to all these little objects, which are very lovely, and I loved those little cuts. But that does feel like something that a lot of these kinds of twee films about young slackers, you know, often these days have those kinds of very, what's the word I'm looking for? It just feels like something that this kind of attention to decor and sight gags, I guess that's the word I'm looking for, these kinds of like sight gags that are created out of mise-en-scene. But then, you know, when one of the misadventures that you were referring to is him, he takes the bus and then the bus has a breakdown and then he goes with someone to get some food and then realizes they might miss the next bus. And there's this long shot of him and the other guy like running up this sort of bridge, the zigzagging bridge. And it's such a beautiful shot, you know? So you go from these cutaways to these little objects that feel a little bit twee, that feel a little bit like television small scale, and then you go to this like incredibly cinematic shot which is both funny but also very beautiful and captures this urban atmosphere so well. So I was really taken with that and quite like how the film has that balance. Vadim, you have anything to add?
I got a few things. First of all, I just kind of want to shout out, not only one of my Letterboxd mutuals who had seen the film prior to me watching it, the indefatigable Felipe Furtado from Brazil.
Of course.
Mm. And one of the things that his capsule kind of makes clear is that, you know, well, to us, he's a new director, and I think this is his second feature, but this is guy's kind of a force in Brazilian film production. The star of the film is actually his brother, Renato. The director has produced a Mars One for Gabriel Martins. So he's like baked into this.
Also a new director selection.
Yeah. And so, but you know, the very first shot of the film before the Shrek pot, or the water even, is one of those shots that kind of tells you, I've seen a lot of movies. There's a kind of very carefully positioned diagonal bookcase, and there's a song playing, and about a minute and a half in, you see like the tiniest flicker of a shadow passing over the upper left side, and you're like, aha, I know who you are. And the movie kind of, you know, is very much in the familiar but different zone of assured festival filmmaking. Certainly the use of the music that Clint was talking about, you know, presumptively anachronistic or disjunctive, but in fact elevating the lives of the protagonists who are not normally graced with the kind of dignity of this kind of music. But also, you know, it's, I think the other thing that hasn't been brought up is it is a nice film. It is pleasant. It gets a lot of low-key drollery, all the kinds of things that we've come to expect. It is a movie about people of color in white spaces, and it is a movie that is implicitly about that two ways. One is the actual setting of the film itself, and one is the film itself within the festival landscape. In that respect, it's reminiscent of Medicine for Melancholy, a movie that also had a lot of the gestures of that, but also directly addressed and made text.
Barry Jenkins' first feature, for those who may not know.
But Medicine for Melancholy, for those of you who also may not remember, is about a fairly unpleasant man who like spends a lot of the movie being pretty upset. And not wrongfully so, but it just puts a different charge on the whole movie. About halfway through this, it's kind of the only time in the movie that this actually becomes directly text. I mean, there's a couple of times. There's a moment where this guy is just trying to chill outside the school and has to explain to a nice, well-meaning white parent who Malcolm X is on a mural behind the wall, right. You know, on them, which may have a slightly different valence in a Brazilian context.
I'm also, not sure. One reason he's late is because he lives so far away. Presumably.
And relies on... And actually, when the bus breaks down, you also see kind of a snapshot of all the people taking the bus to work.
Yeah.
And that there is also a kind of racial, obviously, component to that. The people who rely on public transport and have to commute a lot to get to their jobs.
When he meets his romantic interest for the film, and they are removed from a professional to a personal context, as it were, pretty much the first thing they say is like, the first time I saw it, it was so nice to see another person of color in the school. Because there have been none, and it doesn't really come back for the rest of the film. And it's interesting because the director wants to make a traditional film within these types of movies that he clearly likes very much, but also has to acknowledge that he's going to make them about people who are in his life and that these people are often not shown in these films. So we're walking a very fine line here of the whole like representation matters versus like, do I want to make the whole movie about this kind of thing? And I certainly cannot speak to the place of the larger Brazilian state of cinema at this time. I do not know if this is a quote unquote welcome corrective, an anomaly, part of like a whole saturation of things like this. But in the context of nice festival movies that have slight something kind of new to offer in their visual language, while also not being myopic about the context in which they take place, it kind of fires on both parts. Also have to point out, the movie is 71 minutes.
Yep.
Oh. It is really 65 Beautiful. Before you get to the end credits.
The correct length for all movies of this kind, yes.
Yeah. And so it's certainly not an overly onerous time investment, nor does it have too much faith in attenuating, you know, the necessary, you know, like, let's get this to 90 minutes, guys.
This is my favorite thing about that you bring to these new directors podcasts.
Oh, the running times?
Yeah, we just got an. I mean, it's helpful. I have got to break that down.
Various trivia.
Yeah. Time management is my specialty. So that's what I got here.
Great. I think that was that's some really good context that I hadn't looked up. So thank you to Felipe's Letterboxd. Shout out. So The Day I Met You, 70-minute reprieve, we recommend. Alyssa, I'd love to hear about a film that I know that you had liked and wanted to talk about, and that is Explanation for Everything. Is that the correct title?
Yes.
There's also Exhibiting Forgiveness, and I'm getting... Oh. It's like Explanation for Forgiveness?
Yes. Anyway, yes. I mean, you know, and who know? I never know what the, you know, how literal the translation is. Yeah, I really was pleasantly surprised by this movie, in part because... In stark contrast to the last one, it's over 2.5 hours long, which is a little rare, I think. You know. Yeah, right. So I went in with some trepidation, but, you know, it was the first movie of the day that I saw that day. So I was ready for it. This is a Hungarian film. You know, Hungarian is not among my languages, but Gábor Reich, I believe, is the name of the director. And it's a really interesting movie. So while watching it, I kept thinking about a film from last year that wound up Oscar nominated, which was The Teacher's Lounge, a German film that takes place in a school and kind of uses the school and what happens inside of it as a kind of a microcosm onto society, and kind of what's going on in European politics and in German politics in particular. This film is a little similar to that. So it's about a high school senior in Budapest who's named Abel, who is trying to pass his exams so that he can go on to university, as are all of his classmates. And the film is kind of told elliptically. So it's sort of, we see things happen to Abel, and then we kind of go backwards and see them happen to his father from a different perspective. And then the teacher, who's this... He's like a hot young guy who teaches history. There's a student who's in love with him who's not a Bell. And so there's all these kinds of pieces that are floating around. But it takes a long time for you to figure out what the movie is, but it's very entertaining to watch for that long time. You're kind of just along for the ride. And slowly you come to realize that a Bell, you know, is having difficulty with his exams. It turns out he kind of flunks them, and he gives an answer to his parents about why he flunked them that is not incorrect, but not completely correct either. And then it sort of snowballs into a film that would be abysmal, I think, in less assured hands, which is like, oh, you know, every social media and everybody has, you know, a story, and no, whose story is the right story. But what you kind of the way the film kind of spools itself out is really it's about a debate between people on the right and the left in Hungary, and how that kind of debate can be viewed through different lenses and weaponized for different purposes that actually affect people in their real lives. And it's also very funny in places. It's just the situations that the characters end up in are very funny. But it's pretty tense. It was a pretty tense watch. And it is clearly the kind of film that you could probably remake in many different cultures, because it's such a universal question right now about polarization and also producers, how that affects take note. Teenagers. Yes. but I really enjoyed watching it, and I was at like the press screenings for this one, and I was listening to people talk afterwards and heard like multiple other people talking to friends and being like, oh, that movie, like, it took a while to get going, but boy, I really liked it once it did. So
that's what the people are saying.
Yes, that's what the people are saying. Yeah, it has a very light touch for what could have been a very heavy thing, and a very ponderous thing. And the kind of performances bring you through different headspaces in a really interesting way. So I really enjoyed it. I would definitely recommend it. And I'm glad that I like hauled myself to a 10 a.m. 2.5 hour screening to see it. And nobody else has seen it here, so you're just going to have to take my word for it.
None of us hauled ourselves to the 10 a.m. screening. However, we will catch it during the festival.
It seems hard for a lot of American filmmakers, I think, to find good ways into talking about things like cultural divides over politics, and like Hungary is, you know,
culture wars. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. It's just such a, I like instinctively back away from any American film that is about that topic, but have found that sometimes you can find a better way into it if with a director who is focused on institutions and how those institutions are kind of embedded in and overlap with people's individual commitments. And you also can feel the seeping in of an American media environment into the film, which I think, or into the characters' lives in the film. So even, you know, I only have kind of rudimentary knowledge of Hungarian politics, but even if you don't, I think it's pretty legible and, you know, is maps nicely onto conversations and patterns of thought that we have in our other cultural contexts.
Here's a film that I know that you saw and that you liked quite a bit, Grace. Do you want to talk about that a little bit? It's also sort of, it's a Russian film that doesn't seem to be, that seems to be divorced from any kind of contemporary political turmoil.
Yeah, it took me a while to figure out where we even were in this movie for that reason. I was like, I think they're speaking Russian, but there's a number of different
Speak a bunch of languages, I believe, right?
Yeah, the listing says Russian, Georgian, and Karachay-Balkar, which I don't know anything about, but is like a local language. Yeah, I think I like this one for its dreamlike feeling. So the setup is that, and again, it takes you a while to get into it, but the setup is that you're there's a father and a daughter, you kind of come to understand, who live in a van, and they travel from town to town, and they do a couple different things in order to make money, one of which is like sales of bootleg DVDs, which is a lot of them to like long haul truckers because they're basically in Siberia. And then also they set up...
But not just any bootleg DVDs.
No, not just... What kind of bootleg DVDs are they?
They are pornographic bootleg DVDs they produce. That the daughter and father produce by shooting the truckers having sex with prostitutes. So it's quite a complex operation they have going here.
It is real bootstrapping. So they do this, and then they also show films, non-pornographic films, as far as I could tell. Sort of in like makeshift outdoor theaters.
Classic Russian films.
Yeah. And I think one thing I really quite liked about the movie, which I also couldn't totally tell if it was 100% contemporary or not, the setting, but the daughter says to her father at some point, you know, what are you going to do when everybody gets the internet out here? Which is like an actual kind of fascinating remnant of something that the rest of us just take for granted. And yeah, there's a lot of like stuff about grief in here and stuff about the kind of tense relationship between this, you know, daughter who's adolescent, but basically adult, and her father, who really doesn't have a plan beyond this one and maybe will never be able to have one. They kind of are traveling. So it works like a road movie, I think. But it doesn't feel or look like one when you're watching it, and there's none of the buoyancy that you expect from a road movie. It's sad. It's a sad movie, but yeah, I know Tarkovsky has been mentioned in conjunction with it, and there's definitely a little bit of that in there. You didn't like it as much, though, Clinton, right?
I felt tricked by this movie. I thought it was extraordinarily beautiful. The opening sequence, in fact, is like kind of stunning visually, but I feel like off the bat, I felt that the characters were like at core were just kind of hollow, and that they were stand-ins for figures that the filmmaker had in mind, and that a lot of the behavior that was being described was there was an element to me of poverty porn going on throughout the film where we have these like tracking shots of villages where everybody is sort of like every building is dilapidated and the doors are falling off the hinges. But inside you have like families living there and, you know, sure. But every single village, like and then they have laptops, you know, and they have computers, but nobody has phones.
A little bit of that, I think, is in that they are trying to avoid police, right? So they keep going to villages where they're like, are there police here?
And
like,
no. But because they're doing this, like, you know, I don't really like want to dwell on like whether or not it's realistic, but like the idea that they're able to produce pornography at like and like shoot it, light it, edit it in their van, and then carry around all the equipment necessary for like pornography production and the projection of films onto like drive-in theater sized screens and like sell concessions out of their van. It seemed that they like, and the characters say almost nothing to each other, right? The father is apparently kind of like a reader. He's always picking up, he picks up like a couple books, a Vonnegut book on the side of the road. So there's like, other than that, you really have no idea who they are, or like what's going on in their inner lives. They just seem kind of sad. And they have this urn filled with their mother's ashes. And so the ultimate payoff then at the end of the movie is, you know, the daughter reaches some sort of peace with her mother's passing. And I don't know, I just thought it was kind of trite ultimately. And also, and then so, yeah, so then when I read an interview with the director, and it turns out that he has spent his career working in advertising. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. Like, he's using all the tools of advertising to make this kind of sweeping, beautiful vision that ultimately kind of feels like an advertisement for something, like for ennui or like angst, Russian angst.
An advertisement for Russian angst. Yeah.
And like, but I do have to say, like, the first the opening sequence, like, I was like, oh, this is going to be like a Russian Wanda. I was like, this is this beautiful, like, wide shot of this, like, strip mined mountainside, somebody like a small figure.
Yeah, if I could have framed a whole lot of the frames in this, it they're just, you know, stunning. You're kind of like, what are you? Yeah.
But you know, my dislike didn't happen until about three quarters of the way through, and I suddenly was like, wait a minute, like there's like a shell game happening here, and there's just shells. There's nothing under the shells.
The lo-fi OnlyFans idea is very funny to me for some reason.
Yeah. And the daughter's sort of a photographer, an artist. And so there's like, I don't know. It's not without its charms, but I think like ultimately it's kind of, there's not much going on under the hood.
You know, when I started thinking about what am I actually looking at here, it felt very much like a film about looking. Why frame that inside of a road movie? I don't know, but there is that element, as you mentioned, about the daughter has one of those Polaroids, the new chunky kind that you can buy in like a shop on Fifth Avenue or whatever. And but only photographs people or wants to photograph people as they're kind of turning away from the camera from the back. And that's what her interest is. And it's this kind of...
I mean, it's just like a little like... That's what I'm saying. It's like a little forced. And then the daughter also apparently is adolescent. I think she gets her first period in the opening scene. Or that's what it's implied. But as you said, she's like approaches life like an adult. So there's just, to me, doesn't take the characters seriously. But I think we can move on to something we're a little bit more enthusiastic about. Or you're enthusiastic about it, but go ahead.
Well, I have one that I'm really enthusiastic about, and that is Dreaming and Dying by Singaporean director Nelson Yeo. And I was actually on the jury last year at the Locarno Film Festival for the first features, and we awarded this film. And just kind of had this like immediate unanimous love for it among our options. But I think in general, it's a very exciting film. Vadim, do you want to maybe set it up a little bit?
I can set it up a little bit, although I haven't seen it since Locarno, but I bet you haven't either.
I have not. Yeah. But you know, a lot of it has really stayed with me.
This episode of the Film Comment Podcast is supported by Cinema Made in Italy, presenting La Chimera. Everyone has their own chimera, something they try but never manage to find. The new Italian film La Chimera is a magical journey from Alice Rohrwacher, director of The Wonders and Happy as Lazaro, featuring Isabella Rossellini and Josh O'Connor, known for his performance as Prince Charles in the series The Crown. La Chimera was featured in competition at the 2023 Cannes Film Festival, and Time Out called the film sublime. Peter Bradshaw, writing for The Guardian, describes it as a beguiling fantasy comedy of lost love, garrulous, uproarious, and celebratory. It's a movie bustling and teeming with life. Roar Walker herself has been hailed as the future of cinema. La Chimera opens exclusively in theaters this Friday, March 29th, in New York and Los Angeles, and is coming soon to additional cities. For more information, go to cinemamadeinitaly.com.
There is a couple, and they are reuniting with a third part of what used to be a kind of student triad. It's supposed to be a reunion weekend. The couple are apparently not so happily married. There's some romantic tension and a lot of Hong Sang-soo zooms. Then we move into the Apichatpong portion of the proceedings in the second half as we transition into a trek into the forest, complete with subsonic booming murmurings, the sound of something present but not seen, so on and so forth, ultimately culminating in something that is neither like Hong or Apichatpong for a brisk 90 seconds. To really bring it home at the end. If you suspect from the synopsis I just gave that Devika likes this movie a little bit more than me, that's probably correct. But that is the substantive engagement of the film, as it were. I was talking earlier about the like similar but different thing, which I feel like is like 75% of my festival film write-ups. It is there. You know, I was very sympathetic to the kind of dilemmas that this movie is facing. One of which is that it's a Singaporean film, mm-hmm. And so you know, early on, there's a shot of them by this like ridiculous like statue of like a hand pointing up in the air, and it's kind of a striking location. And after that, after watching it, I went on Letterboxd, and like one of the top reviews is this young Singaporean filmmaker who's like, "I've shot there. Everyone else has shot there. That's what happens when you have a small island and not that many places to shoot like overtly surreal locations." So you can see, and it's funny because, you know, unlike some of these, you know, Clint was just talking about, I mean, the Yi shout out or anti shout out there, we're all working with within frames of reference. The question is what you do with it. This filmmaker's background is actually in short films that use a lot of archival. I think there's one that's primarily about springtime in a small town, I believe. So it does make things a little different. We're just like, you know, that the person is not even trying to cover their tracks. They're trying to readapt them to a different context.
Yeah.
I cannot claim that I have been overly inundated with Singaporean films in the last decade. And the film's heart is in the right place. That's what I got.
So backhanded, Vadim.
No, my review online is even more backhanded.
Yes, it wears its references very proudly. Every single review, the plot synopsis on the New Directors New Films website, all of these descriptions of the film reference the Hong Sang-soo and the Apichatpong elements. But the film really is playing with those, so it doesn't feel like a copy. And I have to say, you see a lot of young filmmakers, especially from East Asia, Southeast Asia, who are borrowing from these filmmakers, right? At festivals, you see a lot of kind of borrowed flourishes. And in this case, I think what works is there are these clear homages, but the film also has a really kind of parodic approach to these references. And you know, when you talk about the Apichatpong section, Vadim, yes, there's the forest and there's these kind of eerie, dreamy elements like sounds and spirits, you know, this insinuation about spirits. But it's also, I don't know, there's like a talking fish, you know, and there's this whole sequence. I don't want to...
Is it like a puppet, a Muppet?
It's not a Muppet, but it's also not a sophisticated kind of VFX or anything, you know, there's something crude about it. I don't want to spoil the sequence, but there's something, there's a mermaid bit. And there are just these elements that are so, first of all, so funny. Just, I found myself laughing so often during the film, but also just crude and yeah, just parodic in a way where these references are being taken, but also being kind of made fun of in intelligently. And so you do get the sense of this is a very smart young filmmaker who is both really inspired by these greats, but also bringing a kind of younger, a slightly more skeptical vision
TikTok generation.
No, but it's really, it's also like a very beautiful film. The shots are very beautiful. So there is this kind of, there's a crudeness, but there's also these beautiful shots of nature and this blue-green kind of aqueous palette throughout. I also have to say the performances are so wonderful, especially the actress who plays the woman in the love triangle, Doreen To. You know, again, just Hong Sang-soo-esque in the sense that sort of droll in a way where they're both, they're all kind of miserable, but also you can sense that they're performing, you know, the sense of misery and kind of don't take themselves too seriously and are a little bit pathetic. I mean, that's my favorite thing about Hong films. All the characters are so pathetic, especially the men. The men in this movie are so pathetic, but actually the woman is, she goes through some strange transformations in the film, both physical and emotional, but really emerges, I think, as a very accomplished comic turn. And I think that is what I want to kind of highlight about this movie, is that it is very, very funny, even more so than Hong Sang-soo films, which are funny, but in this kind of subtle way. And this one is like, it's not afraid to really go for gags while still having musings about spirituality and love. I mean, there's slight queer elements at a certain point. I feel quite happy recommending this. And if you are a fan of these other filmmakers, you'll enjoy it, but you'll also find something, I think, different here.
I'll pick up on that for a second. Just you were focusing a little bit more on what he does with the Apichatpongian elements, but Hong and Apichatpong both went to the Art Institute of Chicago. They both have kind of been cited, you know, to inspire generations of fairly wealthy Asian students to also go to the Art Institute of Chicago, their parents being hopeful that they will replicate their successes. They are important filmmakers, but Hong at this point in his career, meaning for about the last 5 years, no longer actually makes these kinds of movies. He makes them in black and white generally. They look a lot worse. Their emotional interests are more muted. So I see here a little bit of a pathway towards just like these alternate currents, like going backwards in his filmography and reworking that to a different end. And part of the reason this is interesting to me right now is that with Dustin Guy Duffa's The Adults, we have reached the point where the Hong influence has crept into a Michael Cera movie. So we're going to be seeing an awful lot more of this in unexpected directions. And so this is kind of a, you know, it's because Hong is in some ways not an overtly visual spectacular filmmaker, but once you see that element, you cannot unsee it. Mm-hmm. And it would require the level of the visual precision of the late David Bordwell to get into it. But it is there, and it is done in a productive fashion that is also, like I said, like going backwards like 6 years and trying to pick up where somebody left off before they went into slightly different direction.
I will say I disagree slightly, because the newest Hong film that was at Berlin, A Traveler's Needs, I think is... I disagree with the idea that Hong has moved on from a certain kind of filmmaking.
I would not be able to speak to that because I had to stay in and produce a magazine rather than go cheer Carlo Shatrian. But I believe you. I'm sure it's true.
Yeah, I think that actually brings back some early... or it takes Hong back to some of that earlier work. And actually, when I was watching it, I thought of Dreaming and Dying, because A Traveler's Needs, which we will get into later this year again. But Isabelle Huppert is the central character, and there's a kind of, and she's very, very funny. She's kind of the comic heart of A Traveler's Needs. And there is some kind of resonance between that sort of, the Hong woman who is as awkward and strange and pathetic as the men, which I don't think we've seen for a little while. And I think Dreaming and Dying has that sort of character that I just really enjoyed. And yeah, again, Doreen To is so fantastic. Do we want to talk about a film that is not funny in any way? A Good Place.
I mean, I do.
It is so serious.
I thought it was... I don't think that's true. I think that there's some humor, and I think it's quite funny, actually, I would argue. My favorite of the films that I saw from the new director's new films lineup.
It's fantastic, yeah. And I should say this was also in the Locarno selection, and we gave it a sort of second place. I forget the exact title of the award. So these Dreaming and Dying and A Good Place were both in that competition.
Well, A Good Place is like, it pairs well with Grace, and that I think Grace could easily be seen as sort of a post-apocalyptic road movie. And A Good Place is like,
oh yeah, for
is
sure.
like
yeah.
post-apocalyptic. And also, in you know, in keeping with this trend of like great sui generis filmmakers exerting a strong influence on the younger generation, I think this film is heavily indebted to the work of Angela Chanelec.
One of two, I think, in the lineup of Living Without Illusion is also kind of a Chanelecian film, and I think actually made by a student of Chanelec's. But anyway, go on, Clint.
Well, but this, the difference here is it's pretty, it's also doing something very different. It's using some of the same techniques, the ellipses, the like acting, the affectless acting, and a lot of the and dialogue that's just sort of, you know, like non sequiturs. But also there's like an element of theater happening as well. Like the blocking is very theatrical, but the film is about a group of young people. Well, a group of people, there's some old people too at the beginning, who are living on a farm in rural Germany, during some sort of apocalyptic slow motion apocalypse that's overtaking the globe, which we learn about through a radio that is constantly bipping off and on in the background of different scenes. And the film focuses on two young women, Gute and Margarita, two friends, one of whom lives on this in this farm commune, and the other of Gute, I think her name is, lives with a man in a house nearby. Although, again, it's really difficult to keep track of where of what's going on because it's all sort of taking place in this dream world, dream, according to this dream logic. People move and shift, relationships kind of that you thought were static suddenly seem to dissipate, and then people kind of pair off with other people. But the gist of it is that there's some sort of elite, like global elite, who are building a rocket to take people off the earth to save them from whatever mysterious ailment is killing everything and everyone. The only food that people are eating is are chickens and like nuts and acorns that they gather from the woods. There's and then people become mysteriously ill. There are people who just, and then they keep talking about other people who disappear suddenly. So I don't know. So, but as I was saying, what was funny about this movie to me is like this central idea that is implied that people are turning into chickens, which is quite comical, like, and I think it's supposed to be. Like, there's a lot of cutaways to, like, oh, I miss, like, oh, I'm so sad. Like, Maria is gone. She has succumbed. And then, like, cutaway to a chicken, like, wandering through a field. It's pretty funny. Or, like, chicken feet of the chickens that they've eaten. This is like a, and so there's this kind of goofy element. But it is basically, like, you know, pretty dread infused.
It's very somber and very self-serious. I mean, everyone is talking in this grave manner. And because you don't fully understand what this apocalypse is, you can't also always follow what people are talking about. I mean, it's really like you are kept at a distance from this world, even though you're in it, you're in this house, you're in this commune. There's this kind of, there's a veneer that you can't pierce. You don't quite understand what's happening. There's a kind of cool distance.
And anytime you think that you've found some answer, it's sort of undermined. Like even with the transforming into chickens, that's just like, maybe that's not what's happening.
There's like a sense of like an avant-garde theater piece to this, you know, where it's almost like you're not supposed to follow what's going on. Everyone is really kind of performative and maybe are just operating out off of non sequiturs. But there is this mounting dread that Clint mentioned, and also this sense of menace. There are these flashes of violence, especially that couple in the house, Margarita and the man she lives with. But it's never really, you don't really understand what kind of relationship they have, but you see these flashes of danger and menace. and the sense that she's somehow trapped, but nothing is ever articulated in very simple or obvious terms. And they live in nature, all these fields around them, but it feels very claustrophobic and constricting, and so much of the soundscape is just the sound of, you know, of nature.
No, and like there's a lot of like old time rock, like rockabilly songs and like country, like Carter Families, or there's like a Hank Williams song, the one about the end of the world.
And you know, when I saw this film in the theater in Locarno, a lot of it does seem very tedious, but it is doing things to you without you realizing. You're watching, you're like, I don't follow this. This is slow. Where is this going? But it's planting a sense of dread under your skin. The tension kind of mounts. You are forming attachments to some of the characters without realizing. And then it has this incredibly intense last 20 minutes, which I won't spoil, but just you suddenly realize how much it has built up like a pressure cooker. And this ending gestures to a kind of escape, a kind of freedom that involves Guta and Margarita and the man who is maybe kind of some kind of vessel of violence and force. And so it's just a movie that really takes you by surprise and operates on you in an unexpected way. And I really hope that people seek it out and they stick with it. You know, I think there are people who are going to be tempted to walk out because they don't get it. It feels slow, but I think it's really worth the payoff and sticking out through the end. And it's really, directorially, it just feels so impressive, you know? There's just a sense of control over every aspect of the film, where even if you don't understand what's going on, you know that there's an extremely rigorous vision behind it. So, yeah. Strong thumbs up. We're almost out of time, but I wanted to give Alyssa and Vadim, I know you guys saw some films that we didn't, that you liked, so just an opportunity for some shout-outs. Alyssa, do you want to go first?
Yeah, so when I watched Sundance, I was virtual this year, and I watched all documentaries. I saw one non-documentary, so I missed a lot of the movies that people are talking about, including the opening night film, which I plan to see opening night. But one that I had missed and was eager to see was Good One, which I know has been discussed, so I won't go into detail, but I just wanted to say that you know, it's got kind of Leave No Trace vibes to it. It's very simple and funny and well put together, but also like weirdly triggering a thing that, in a good way, I think. I wouldn't want to give away what happens, but essentially the thing that happens in the movie that makes the teenage girl who's at its center flip how she sees the world is so perfectly subtle. And the performance is so perfectly subtle that I like felt some like almost like latent memories reemerge in myself without feeling like I was being manipulated. So it's a really remarkable movie that I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about for a while, including the lead actress, Lily Collius, who's a new face, but is really kind of amazing. So I loved it. It had everything that I want out of that kind of a movie. And I also, once again, feel like we've seen so many movies in the wake of Me Too and all that, that, you know, are trying to get at something fundamental about what it actually is to feel objectified, and not sort of what the broad, you know, kind of mass media version of that is. And so this movie does it just about as well as anything I've seen, maybe better. And I think it's great.
I'm excited to see that one.
Vadim, you had a short, and I would love to hear about your shorts picks.
At the end of Shorts Program 2, the North American premiere, following its 2023 Rotterdam premiere, Cameron Warden's Digital Devil Saga. Cameron Warden, Chicago Film Society projectionist, filmmaker. This will be showing on 35mm.
Are you from Chicago, buddy?
No.
Oh, you're like Chicago. You're just deep, deep Chicago knowledge.
He's actually sponsored by Chicago.
Yeah. I like Chicago. It's a nice city. I've never seen a John Hughes movie from start to finish, but support it. Wait, no, it's in Planes, Trains. Anyway, Cameron Warden has chosen to make an 11-minute Flickr film consisting of two important elements. One is a soundtrack that I think there's a Soulja Boy mixtape in there. Because I heard that in the mix, but the descriptions I read say Chicago hip hop and mixtapes. He's taken a bunch of garbage from the internet and painstakingly transferred it to film. So anime memes, reaction shots, just an absolute chaos of stuff that I see scrolling through my timeline that makes me turn off my feeds, and then transplanted it to the seemingly anachronistic realm of the all analog Flickr film. Producing something that is both kind of viscerally exciting and also viscerally unpleasant in the way that Flickr films often can be, Flickr films can be energizing. This one is a little bit depressing just because of the content of it is just like sludge. But the world is a depressing place. The way that it works, you know, I didn't get to see the 35mm print. It wasn't press screen, so I watched it at home on my okay-ish projector screen setup. And there are moments where it does indeed do the classic Flickr film, just like, let's get white and black, let's strobe it out. And you can see these things being reapplied. To what end? I wouldn't be entirely comfortable saying, although I am amused by Warden's description somewhere basically saying that now that it's on 35mm, don't worry about the ephemerality of the internet, because it's all here on the same analog storage medium. But that was certainly different. That, you know, for all I know, there are, you know, dozens and dozens of young filmmakers who have the money, time, and energy to, like, output frame by frame internet stuff onto 35mm, but I kind of doubt it a little bit. So that's a recommendation with a side of queasiness.
Seems as good a note as any to wrap up. Thank you so much, Alyssa and Vadim, for joining us, helping us preview this year's lineup. There's obviously so many films that we haven't covered, you know, not for any reason other than time is limited and there are many movies. So I encourage people to check out the movies we've talked about, but also venture into the rest of the lineup. And I'm sure all of us are going to do that in the next coming week.
That's a good tagline, I think. Time is limited. There are many movies.
I think it's the theme of our lives as film critics.
To a certain extent, for sure.
That's what we do.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye.
The Film Comment podcast features original music by Greg Einge. Film Comment is a publication of Film at Lincoln Center. Since 1962, Film Comment has been the home of independent film journalism, publishing in-depth interviews, critical analysis, and feature coverage of mainstream, arthouse, and avant-garde filmmaking from around the world. Visit us online at filmcomment.com.